There's a new world coming, it's already here. There's a new world on its way. There's a new world coming, it's already here. Let's begin to live that way.
Welcome to the Children, Youth, and a New Kind of Christianity podcast series. The following presentation was recorded live at the 2012 CYNKC conference organized by Dave Sinis and others in Washington, D.C., and presented by Calvary Baptist Church, Woodlake Publishing, Virginia Theological Seminary, and Emergent Village. On May 7 through 10 of that year, conversation partners from seven countries and over 20 denominational traditions gathered to question, share, and be inspired by the alternative trajectory children and youth ministry is taking in certain contexts. Here now, Brian McLaren, who spoke at the 2012 CYNKC, entitling his reflections, Christian Faith and the Next Generation, Why We Need This Conference. Can you imagine
the city street? I wrote a book, it's hard to believe it was so long ago now, but called A New Kind of Christian back in 2001. And then almost 10 years later, I followed it up with a book that maybe took things, in some ways I opened up the box, and in 2010, I was ready to step out of the box. Say, look, we have got to deal with some deep questions about where the Christian faith is going. I had a funny experience about a year after the book came out. A lady who works with me, who's kind of my scheduler and all the rest, her name's Lacey. Lacey texted me, I think, which she almost never does, and you know, said, check your email or something. I just forwarded an email to you. So I checked my email, and it was from the Vatican. Now, when you're a Protestant boy and you hear from the Vatican, you feel like the principal has called you down to his office. And it was especially disconcerting because I feel like I understand how the nuns feel, you know. Because it didn't give any indication what it was about. It was just, I'm so-and-so, I work for the Vatican, I'm trying to reach Brian McLaren, would you have him contact me? So I sent him an email. He emailed me back. He said, your book, A New Kind of Christianity, was translated into Italian. And he said, I just read it. And he said, you're asking exactly the questions that we must ask. Then he went on to say, it's not easy for me to talk about these things where I work. And he said, but I have seminarians talking about them, I have congregations talking about them, and I wonder if you and I could enter into some dialogue off the record about these things, because we've got to deal with these questions. So in many places, there's increasing openness to grapple with this, although there's pushback. So here we find ourselves in this strange moment where our religious communities, it doesn't matter if you're Catholic, Protestant, it doesn't matter if you're mainline Protestant or evangelical, isn't it strange? Everybody's in the same boat. That we have two ways of being Christian, a liberal way and a conservative way. And we tend to, in Protestant circles, talk about evangelical or mainline, although anybody who's been around knows there are a lot more conservatives in the mainline than most people realize, and although it's becoming more apparent in certain settings. And there aren't as many more liberal people in evangelical churches, and most of the ones who are in the closet, one way or the other. And then what has happened in the lifetime of many of us in this room is we've watched conservatives and liberals increasingly polarize and increasingly define themselves in opposition to one another. But meanwhile, many of us feel that this paradigm shift is happening. It was the fall of the Iron Curtain, the collapse of communism, but many of us feel we're seeing something similar happen in the West, the collapse of a fossil fuel-based economy, the unsustainability of the kind of militarism that is endemic in our culture, the growing gap between rich and poor that is becoming increasingly unsustainable. Put all of those things together, and we just have this feeling that what we're doing isn't working. And so while conservatives are feeling so superior to liberals, and liberals are feeling so superior to conservatives, they're on these superior paths to irrelevance in equal and opposite ways. And so what happens is when people on those two trajectories start to realize that they don't want to keep going the direction they're going, they start to defect from those trajectories and find each other, and they start talking about what's not working. And even though their compatriots from their own heritage feel so different, once they make a break from that trajectory, they realize they have a lot in common. Namely, we know what we're doing isn't working, and we don't know what to do instead. Let's talk. See, that's our road to Emmaus conversation. So we find ourselves in this process of imagining some new kind of Christian faith that is emerging, and I think we can look back maybe 100 years and realize there have been different movements. I don't think there's one movement that gets this. There's been many movements, kind of like when the tide comes in. You know, there's a lot of waves, and they each are the building of an incoming tide. But what a lot of us have noticed, and I've been deeply involved with this my whole 24 years as a pastor, we did lots of experimentation for adults. And I always wanted to get around to doing more for kids, but we didn't do enough. And it was a continual struggle, because we hadn't figured out our own script yet, and we didn't really know what we were doing. Actually, we did think we knew what we were doing, we just didn't really know. But we didn't know that we didn't know yet. So you know what I mean? You have to go through a process till you realize, I thought that little Band-Aid was going to fix it. But then I needed, major surgery. And I'm still recovering from that process. And more recently now, we have a lot of people paying attention to how we can reclaim the dropouts, because dropout rates have been going up in church. And a lot of attention to how to promote retention. How can we keep people from dropping out? But there hasn't been that much attention to the good reasons why people drop out and the changes that are needed, because it might be worse for them to stay. Jesus said that once. He said, you Pharisees travel over land and sea, and once you get a convert, you turn him into twice the son of hell he was before. And I bet a lot of us either have felt this way, have done this, or know people who've left the church, and we think, yeah, it's probably better. Because if you were to come back, it would kill you. And to some degree, that depends on where you live and what options there are. But I had this strange situation after having been a pastor for 24 years, moving to a new place and needing to find a church. And the first church I visited, I thought I was going to hear a sermon preached about me that Sunday. The sermon was all about the evils of the emerging church. And I thought, they're going to quote me, And it was weird. And I just thought, I don't want to stay around for coffee, So in the little community where I live, there are, I think, seven or eight churches. And I know I would not be, I wouldn't be allowed to attend five of them. They would ask me not to attend if I showed up. My options were narrowed. And I have an awful lot of friends like that. And probably a lot of us in this room feel like that. That's why I think it's important, the work that people like Dave Kinnaman have done, trying to quantify what is driving people away. You're probably familiar with his book, You Lost Me, where young adults he tries to articulate the reasons young adults are leaving. The church is overprotective, which ends up being a creativity killer. They're shallow, with a lot of easy platitudes. They're anti-science. And here, science welcomes questions and inquiry, and the church opposes that kind of curiosity, repressive, exclusive, and doubtless. I mean, overconfident, what I call excessive confidence, which makes it unsafe to ask an honest question. And so when you take that as the background, that we know we're in trouble, what are we doing now with kids and youth? Well, first, we're inducting children into a form of Christian faith that no longer works for increasing numbers of adults. And I think that's one of the main things. You wouldn't have come to a conference entitled like this, with a title like this, if you didn't have some sense for that. And it's across the board. Evangelicalism isn't working for increasing numbers of adults. I'm shocked by the number of people I meet in my travels who are evangelicals who've dropped out of church, even more shocked by the number of evangelical pastors who didn't just drop out of the pastorate. They're out of the whole business. And no indications. They're not saying, I really can't wait to come back. And it's true among mainline or traditional Protestants. The dropout rates are staggering. And the number of churches that haven't had it children's ministry in decades because they're like out of the parents' generation and out of the grandparents' generation. You know, they're distant from having kids around. And in Roman Catholicism, I just think for all the Catholics in the room, you'll know there are pockets of great vitality and vast stretches of autopilot where things are just running on and nobody's paying attention whether anybody's being helped or not. And so you put all that together and you just realize all of our Christian traditions have peaked and they're now struggling with a post-peak depression. What my friend Diana Butler Bass calls the religious bear market. And here we are. In that context, we do have a good amount of experimentation with fresh approaches for teenagers and young adults. But by and large, those experiments are about style and not substance. And probably in many cases, pedagogically, some of the best stuff that's ever been produced. And even in spite of our increased expenditures and the hard work of people like you, the dropout rates continue to be high. It would be interesting if any of you could do this. If you aren't already doing this, might be an interesting thing to try for the next few years. But if you have records and relationships, you could go back. If you have a children and youth ministry where you can track a better than 20% retention rate, this is really depressing, okay? But a better than 20% retention rate, you better let the rest of us know what you're doing. And a whole lot of people won't know because the way we've set up the system, we don't notice. Partly because kids go away to college, and partly because the gap between youth group and church is nobody's paying attention. Nobody's, to borrow a phrase from the London Underground, nobody's minding the gap. And so when that happens, then we hope they'll come back, we lament when they don't, and we feel guilty when we notice. You know, there's a lot of parents who feel really guilty because their kids have dropped out of church. And let me just offer this to you. If you did a great job of bringing your kid as close as possible to the level where you are, and if you're honest and your church isn't offering much to where you are, do you understand that your success in bringing your kid so far might be why your kid isn't going? But for all those people who feel guilty, an event like this suggests that some have started talking about whole life spiritual formation and a new kind of Christian faith. Listen, if you're in kids ministry, it's not enough to talk about doing great kids ministry, because if you do a great job of passing the baton onto the youth leaders and they muff it, then, you know, that's a waste of your energy in some ways. Not a waste, but you know what I mean. And if youth workers, you do an unbelievable job in caring for your kids, and then in that 1 year out of high school, it just stops working. Then this is, and let me tell you, it's not over yet. Because then we've got to start realizing that an awful lot of people in their 40s and 50s, what I wrote about in Naked Spirituality as stage three and stage four, and what my friend Richard Rohr talks about as the second half of life, there's increasing numbers of adults who are dropping out as soon as they raise their kids. They drop out too. And so we're going to have to relook at this whole package. Now, when I say a new kind of Christian faith, some people get nervous about that. They say, we don't need new kind, we need the old kind. Okay, you know, we need the old kind of Christian faith that always evolves. Because the Christian faith evolves from Acts 1 to Acts 28. And it evolves from the Gospel of Matthew to the Gospel of John. The Christian faith has been an evolutionary faith from the beginning. And so we're not being faithful if we have a frozen in a box faith. The ancient Christian faith is an evolving faith. And anything that evolves is always both conservative and progressive. You understand that when a species evolves, you know, 99.999% of its DNA stays the same. It's just that there's a couple of small changes in the code that make it possible to adapt to new conditions. And so it's always conservative, but there's always the room for the mutation and the adaptation. And of course, even evolution itself is only optional. You don't have to evolve. You can go extinct. And forms of Christian faith have come and gone, and anything could happen. And if you doubt that, think of 1989 to 1991. Who would have guessed in 1988 that communism would be a thing of the past? So this, and the great news is this is already in progress, and people have been grappling with these changes for years. One of the things I'm really looking forward to this week is hearing John Westerhoff, and because John Westerhoff has been talking about these things for decades. And another one of my great heroes is Jerome Berryman, and he couldn't be here for this, but Godly Play has been an innovator in this whole process, and people like the Network of Biblical Storytellers are out there thinking some important new thoughts, and we've got people from curriculum and publishing companies that are really pressing the limits, and probably in this room, we have so much creativity in this room. It could be that everything we need for the next 30 years is already in this room. It just has to be unpacked and disseminated, which is one of the reasons for getting this group together, so we can find each other and start sharing ideas. It's not like we're starting from scratch, but we're still in the process. We've got to ask the what question of what is the purpose of this whole thing? What's the message we're proclaiming? What does it look and feel like, this new kind of Christian faith that's emerging? We've got to ask the how question. How do we do it? How do we get from here to there? I mean, but very important, we've got to ask the who question. And that's really kind of where I want to go tonight. The who question, meaning who are we and what condition are we in? Came across a quote recently from Otto Scharmer. Many of you will know him and his work. He said, now he's not talking about the church, but when he says the system, we could apply it to the economic system, business systems, educational systems. We could also apply it to our religious systems. What's missing today is a high-quality discourse on rethinking the design and evolution of the entire system from scratch. He doesn't mean, you know, from point zero, but really the whole system, not just taking out this module, but thinking about how the whole system works. The quality of results produced by any system depends on the quality of awareness from which the people in the system operate. And that little sentence is pretty powerful. This is why when people operating from a constricted level of awareness go out and buy the $39.95 program that's going to fix everything in their youth ministry or children's ministry or church or denomination, it doesn't matter how good the program is. When the program doesn't work, people often blame the program. Program might really work. It's just the awareness of the people implementing it that could sabotage the whole thing. So one of the great benefits that's going to come from these days together, and that all of us have to realize is essential to this, is our own openness to the Spirit, our own openness to new ideas, our own openness to what it is that we need to learn next, our own openness to the person next to you, our own openness to ideas that at first will make you angry. And so when they talk about rethinking the entire system, I'm just going to mention, don't have time to go into this, but we're going to open up for questions, discussion in a minute. You can ask about any of these. But there's a lot more we could talk about, but I want to mention seven components, the first of which is a theological detoxification. You know how people always complain about how bad political discourse is? Did you hear we're having a presidential election this year? And I know it, you probably haven't noticed, but it's, and people complain about how bad our politics are. I think what's happened is our political discourse has become as toxic as our religious discourse. I think one of the effects of religious people getting involved in politics is they brought their very low level of discourse into the public sphere. Now politicians are talking the way preachers have always talked. I know that's a little cynical, but some of you grew up with preaching like I did, and you know that defamation, half-truth, exaggeration, it's just part of preaching. And it's very acceptable in religious settings. You don't have to be honest when you're talking about the devil. You know, anything goes. And so what we're dealing with is we're dealing with the possibility, folks, that Christians will blow up the world. The most likely people to create the next Holocaust are Christians. The most likely people to press the button that drops nuclear bombs are Christians. And if not that, the most likely people to have the next BP oil spill were praising Jesus on Sunday and signing false inspection reports on Monday. And the people who are going to make sure that we don't deal with global climate change are Christians. We've got stuff in our religion that if we keep people in churches replicating the kind of faith that's being passed down in many places, we're on the wrong team. I know that's really depressing, but I think I might get an amen. Now, it's not everywhere, but it's out there. And so, you know, we all know in my state, there's this horrible case going on where a father left a loaded gun in his nightstand. A kindergarten child, did you hear about this? Picked it up, put it in his backpack, brought it to school, and shot somebody. And you think, well, I mean, it's just tragic beyond description. But there are Bible verses lying around like loaded guns. And it's why whatever you think of Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and all the rest, it's what they're trying to tell us. That you've got loaded weapons in your nightstand in the Gideon Bible. And if we're going to be responsible children and youth workers, we've got to deal with the loaded weapons that empower religious violence. And listen, people's lives are at stake because of our religious suspicion. And look, the same is true in Islam, and the same is true in Judaism, the same is true in Hinduism, but we better deal with the logs in our own eye. And second, we've got to deal with the issue of identity formation. How can we build a strong Christian identity that is not hostile toward people with other identities? And this is the theme of the book I have coming out this fall. It's what I've been thinking about almost nonstop for the last 18 months. We know how to have strong Christian identities that are hostile toward other faiths, and we know how to have weak Christian identities that are tolerant toward other faiths. What we haven't figured out is how to have a strong Christian identity. The stronger it is, the more benevolent it is to people of other faiths. And Christian identity is largely formed by people like us in this room. It's not, by the time the pastors get them, it's been formed already. And so we have a lot of work to do in developing an usness that welcomes otherness, whether that's the otherness, cultural otherness, political otherness, sexual otherness, spiritual, religious otherness. How can we turn otherness into one anotherness where each identity is respected and intact? And that's a huge challenge for us. Third, we've got to embed in children and youth for that new kind of Christianity that's in the process of being born, a sense of integral mission that puts together the personal, bringing, helping people come into a vital spiritual life, but integrates the personal with the institutional. By the way, institutions are important. And there's been all this, we realize that institutions can malfunction, and then we say, oh, institutions are bad. Listen, if you think institutions are bad and you want your children and grandchildren to agree, you'll have to create institutions to teach them that. Anything that lasts more than a generation involves an institution. So institutional survival is not a bad thing. It's just a question of, what is the institution for, and does it deserve to survive, and, you know, is it doing a good job of it? But beyond that, social mission and economic mission and ecological mission, which I just think, if all of us who are parents and grandparents, if we take, and when you're working with little kids, these poor five-year-olds you're working with, they're probably going to be alive at the beginning of the 21st century. What's the sea level going to be? How many nuclear wars are going to happen between now and then? How many where will the culture wars go by then? And so we start to think, boy, to help kids have a sense of mission in this world, to deal with the really big issues that we face. And then next, rethinking the whole system in terms of lifelong spiritual formation. You see, it used to be we thought children and youth grow and adults just stay the same. We all know what a joke that is. The truth is, adults are dynamic and growing more than anybody. I mean, as much as anybody. And so to think about the spiritual life in a holistic sense, that's what I was trying to do in this book, Naked Spirituality. It's what a lot of people are trying to do, paying attention to stages of human development and spiritual development and so on. And we have so many exciting things to deal with there, including things like rites of passage and so on. What will that mean? It's a little strange to think we've been around for 2,000 years and we haven't developed much in this regard. I'm kind of surprised. My sister-in-law is a math educator. She has a PhD, not just in math, but in math education. And you realize, wow, we know a lot about how to teach people math. We don't know much about how to teach people how to love their enemies after 2,000 years. We don't have a curriculum for teaching people to love their enemies. We don't have a curriculum for teaching people to love themselves. We don't have a curriculum for teaching people to love God. We tell them they ought to, but we haven't got that much. At least it's not very commonly known if we have it. And so there's also all the issues of appropriate technology that we can use. But again, the how questions really come after the what and who questions. All of this is deeply connected to doctrinal reformulation. I love what Diana Butler Bass says in her most recent book, that we've got to rediscover doctrine in its etymological connection to doctor, because a doctrine is supposed to be a healing teaching. But when we turn doctrine into a kind of destructive dogma, we know we're in trouble. And so I'm excited about, you know, 500 years ago, we had the Great Reformation, but which was primarily about structure and power. Maybe now we're in the middle of a doctrinal reformulation, where we're going to see our teachings in a new light and turn them from tools of hostility into healing teaching. And I, you know, some of you have read my books, you know that I think a core of this is rethinking the whole issue of the narrative that we tell, that we assume is a Christian narrative, is probably a Greco-Roman narrative. and that we've got to rediscover other ways of thinking about the biblical narrative, maybe not even as a storyline, but as a story space, the kind of environment where certain kinds of stories can happen. When you start thinking of radical change like that, then we have to think of a very complex problem of rebranding. And I, in some ways, don't like to use a business-related term, but I do want to use this term because I think it's probably going to help us see our problem. Let me say it like this. The brand Roman Catholic has been pretty badly damaged by the pedophilia scandal. And then when the leaders of the church get mad at the nuns for not talking about homosexuality and abortion enough, after they are still discredited for, I mean, it's almost like they're their own worst enemy, you know? But guess what? Protestants are way better at destroying their brand than Catholics. And so we've got serious issues to face. Like, if your main focus is not saving Episcopalianism or saving Baptistism, but your main focus is forming vibrant followers of Jesus Christ, generation by generation, then we might have to start asking some really, really serious questions. Like, what do we want these people to call themselves? But, you know, just when you think about branding, you think about, like, the difference between Coke and Pepsi. What I hear is everybody in blind taste tests prefers Pepsi. But if you tell them they're drinking Coke, they prefer that. So that the actual taste of the product is less significant than the brain's association with a brand. Coke knows something about branding. Contrast that with Enron or Anderson Consulting or BP. Contrast that with Disney, one of the most brilliant branding organizations in the world. You know, Disney is thinking about how to win four-year-olds and give them things that will prepare them for being 14-year-olds, that will prepare them for being 24-year-olds. I wouldn't be surprised if Disney doesn't start opening up. They won't call it a Disney thing, but they'll start, you know, having senior citizen communities. Because they'll have studied these people from birth all the way through to old age. So we've got a lot to learn and think about if we take what we're doing seriously. And then finally, thinking about the whole systems of local churches, the whole systems of denominations, and these larger systemic issues, how can they become sustainable? Just as we're facing issues of sustainable economics, sustainable environmental practice, sustainable business practice, we also have to think about sustainable, and even one step better than sustainable, regenerative practices. Look, I know we've probably got some people in the room who are doing really great in your job, but I'll just tell you, I speak mostly to senior pastors and denominational officials, and there aren't that many that are doing great. There are an awful lot that are less healthy than they were 6 months ago, and they were less healthy 12 months ago, and they're losing ground little by little and hanging on because it's not a sustainable system. And we've got to think about that, and when you put all of those together, you can get a little depressed and think, wow, we got a lot of work to do, but you can also say, wow, we're in on the ground floor of something very, very important. And I'm just going to, please take this, I mean, this could be taken in the wrong way, but I have a feeling that the people working with children and youth have the best chance to really make a difference in this because you don't have the same constituency problems that the senior pastors have. I know there are problems, but there are possibilities. So here we are in this time of amazing change. And let's just remember that so much of the ability to bring the needed change has to do with what happens inside of us. It's not just the ideas, it's the capacities and the sensibility and the attitude. And I'll just close by saying, and this is more personal to me than ever. I have 4 kids, and now 2 of them have kids. And I just had a long talk with my son after playing rapturously with my granddaughter for a few hours yesterday evening. But I had a talk with my son last night about how he feels about church and about what he wants for his daughter. And this is all a live issue. It's a live issue for him. He's really hoping we come up with something good. He's hoping we come up with something good. An awful lot depends on what people like us can do. It's a once-in-a-lifetime chance we have in these few days. And so that's why what happens with you talking with each other and what happens with all of us together, I'm really praying and trusting that the Holy Spirit opens up some great stuff. Amen?
The contents of this podcast episode are reproduced by permission of the presenter and Woodlake Publishing under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations copyright. The Children, Youth, and a New Kind of Christianity podcasts are produced by Melvin Bray and Dave Sinis. The music for the 2012 CYNKC conference and podcasts is contributed by Brian Moyer Suderman. Stay tuned for more podcasts and resources for children, youth, and a new kind of Christianity on the World Wide Web at children-youth.com and woodlakebooks.com.
Can you imagine the world restored, earth and heavens too? Right at home with the one who says, I am making all things new. It's a new world coming, and it's already here.